Get up, Mr. Gonzalez snapped at her. You're going to fall over.
No,
she answered through tight, withered lips.
I'm going to help Gloria. Get down on that side, Gomez. We'll just grab Gloria by the elbows.
Ignatius watched passively while Mr. Gonzalez squatted on his other side. You are distributing your weight incorrectly, he told them didactically. If you are going to attempt to raise me, that position offers you no leverage. I suspect that the three of us will be injured. I suggest that you try a stand-in position. In that way, you can easily bend over and hoist me.
Don't be nervous, Gloria,
Miss Trixie said, rocking back and forth on her haunches. Then she fell forward onto Ignatius, throwing him on his back once again. The edge of her celluloid visor hit him in the throat.
Ugh!
Gurgled from somewhere in the depths of Ignatius's throat.
Blah!
Gloria!
Miss Trixie wheezed. She looked into the full face directly beneath hers.
Gomez, call a doctor! Miss Trixie, get off Mr. Riley!
The office manager hissed from where he squatted beside his two underlings.
Blah!
What are you people doing down there on the floor? A man asked from the door.
Mr. Gonzalez's chipper face hardened into a mask of horror, and he squeaked,
Good morning, Mr. Levy. We're so glad to see you.
I just came in to see if I had any personal mail. I'm driving back to the coast right away. What's this big sign over here for? Somebody's going to get his eye knocked out on that thing.
Is that Mr. Levy?
Ignatius called from the floor. He could not see the man over the row of filing cabinets.
Bah! I have been wanting to meet him.
Shedding Miss Trixie, who slumped to the floor, Ignatius struggled to his feet and saw a sportily dressed middle-aged man holding the handle of the office door so that he could flee as rapidly as he had entered.
Hello there, Mr. Levy said casually. New worker Gonzalez?
Oh, yes, sir. Mr. Levy, this is Mr. Riley. He's very efficient. A whiz. As a matter of fact, he's made it possible for us to do away with several other workers.
Rah.
Oh, yeah, the name on this sign.
Mr. Levy gave Ignatius a strange look.
I have taken an unusual interest in your firm,
Ignatius said to Mr. Levy.
The sign which you noticed upon entering is only the first of several innovations which I plan.
Rah.
I will change your mind about this firm, sir. Mark my word.
You don't say.
Mr. Levy studied Ignatius with certain curiosity.
What about the mail, Gonzalez?
There's not much. You received your new credit cards. Transglobal Airlines sent you a certificate making you an honorary pilot for flying 100 hours with them.
Mr. Gonzalez opened his desk and gave Mr. Levy the mail.
There's also a brochure from a hotel in Miami.
You'd better start making my spring practice reservations. I gave you my itinerary of practice camps, didn't I?
Yes, sir.
By the way, I have some letters for you to sign. I had to write a letter to Abelman's Dry Goods. We always have trouble with them.
I know. What do those crooks want now?
Abelman claims that the last lot of trousers we shipped him were only 2 feet long in the leg. I'm trying to straighten out the matter.
Yeah? Well, stranger things have happened around this place,
Mr. Levy said quickly. The office was already beginning to depress him. He had to get out.
Better check with that foreman in the factory. What's his name? Look, suppose you sign those letters like always. I have to go.
Mr. Levy pulled the door open.
Don't work these kids too hard, Gonzalez. So long, Miss Trixie. My wife asked about you.
Miss Trixie was sitting on the floor, relacing one of her sneakers.
Miss Trixie!
Mr. Gonzalez screamed.
Mr. Levy is talking to you!
Who?
Miss Trixie snarled.
I thought you said he was dead!
I hope that you will see some vast changes the next time that you drop in on us,
Ignatius said.
We are going to revitalize, as it were, your business.
Okay. Take it easy,
Mr. Levy said, and slammed the door.
He's a wonderful man,
Mr. Gonzalez told Ignatius fervently. From a window, the two watched Mr. Levy get into his sports car. The motor roared, and Mr. Levy sped away within a few seconds, leaving a settling cloud of blue exhaust.
"Perhaps I shall get to the filing,"
Ignatius said when he found himself staring out the window at only an empty street.
"Will you please sign that correspondence so that I can file the carbon copies? It should now be safe to approach what that rodent has left of the Abelman folder."
Ignatius spied while Mr. Gonzalez, painstaking, forged Gus Levy to the letters.
"Mr. Riley," Mr. Gonzalez said, carefully screwing the top onto his $2 pen, "I am going into the factory to speak with the foreman. Please keep an eye on things."
By things, Ignatius imagined that Mr. Gonzalez meant Miss Trixie, who was snoring loudly on the floor in front of the file cabinet.
"Seguro," Ignatius said and smiled. "A little Spanish in honor of your noble heritage."
As soon as the office manager went through the door, Ignatius rolled a sheet of Levy's stationery into Mr. Gonzalez's high black typewriter. If Levy Pants was to succeed, the first step would be imposing a heavy hand upon its detractors. Levy Pants must become more militant and authoritarian in order to survive in the jungle of modern commercialism. Ignatius began to type the first step.
"Ebelman's Dry Goods, Kansas City, Missouri, USA. Mr. I. Ebelman, Mongoloid Esquire. We have received via post your absurd comments about our trousers, the comments revealing, as they did, your total lack of contact with reality. Were you more aware, you would know or realize by now that the offending trousers were dispatched to you with our full knowledge they were inadequate, so far as length was concerned."
"Why? Why?" you are in your incomprehensible babble, unable to assimilate stimulating concepts of commerce into your retarded and blighted worldview. "The trousers were sent to you, one, as a means of testing your initiative. A clever, wide-awake business concern should be able to make three-quarter-length trousers a byword of masculine fashion. Your advertising and merchandising programs are obviously faulty. And two, as a means of testing your ability to meet the standards requisite in a distributor of our quality product. Our loyal and dependable outlets can vend any trouser bearing the Levy label, no matter how abominable their design and construction. You are apparently a faithless people. We do not wish to be bothered in the future by such tedious complaints. Please confine your correspondence to orders only. We are a busy and dynamic organization whose mission needless effrontery and harassment can only hinder. If you molest us again, sir, you may feel the sting of the lash across your pitiful shoulders. Yours in anger, Gus Levy, President."
Happily pondering the thought that the world understood only strength and force, Ignatius copied the Levy signature onto the letter with the office manager's pen, tore up Mr. Gonzalez's letter to Abelman, and slipped his own into the correspondent's outgoing box. Then he tiptoed carefully around the little inert figure of Miss Trixie, returned to the filing department, picked up the stack of still unfiled material, and threw it into the wastebasket.
"Hey, Miss Lee! That fat mother got him the green cap. He coming in here anymore?"
"No, thank God. It's characters like that that ruin your investment."
"When your little orphan friend coming here again? Whoa! I like to find out what going on with them orphan. I bet they'd be the first orphan the police be interested in ever."
"I told you I send the orphans things. A little charity never hurt nobody. It makes you feel good."
"That really sound like not a jaw charity when them orphan paying in a lot of money for whatever they getting."
"Stop worrying about the orphans and start worrying about my floor. I got enough problems already. Darlene wants to dance, you want to raise, and I got worse problems on top of that."
Lana thought of the plain clothesman who had suddenly started to appear in the club late at night.
"Business stinks."
"Yeah, I can tell that. I'm starving to death in this cat house."
"Say, Jones, you been over to the precinct lately?"
Lana asked cautiously, wondering whether there was an outside chance that Jones might be leading the cops to the place. This Jones was turning out to be a headache, in spite of the low salary.
"No, I ain't been visiting all my police friend. I'll wait till I get some good evidence."
Jones shot out a nimbus formation.
"I'm waiting for a break in the orphan case. Woo-wee!"
Lana twisted up her coral lips and tried to imagine who had tipped off the police. Mrs. Riley could not believe that it had really happened to her. There was no television. There were no complaints. The bathroom was empty. Even the roaches seemed to have pulled up stakes. She sat at the kitchen table, sipping a little muscatel, and blew away the one baby roach that was starting to cross the table. The tiny body flew off the table and disappeared, and Mrs. Riley said,
"So long, darling."
She poured another inch of wine, realizing for the first time the house smelled different, too. It smelled as close as it ever did, but her son's curious personal odor, which always reminded her of the scent of old tea bags, seemed to have lifted. She lifted her glass and wondered whether Levy Pants was beginning to reek a little of used Pico. Suddenly, Mrs. Riley remembered the horrible night that she and Mr. Riley had gone to the Britannia to see Clark Gable and Jean Harlow in red dust. In the heat and confusion that had followed their return home, nice Mr. Riley had tried one of his indirect approaches, and Ignatius was conceived. Poor Mr. Riley. He had never gone to another movie as long as he lived. Mrs. Riley sighed and looked at the floor to see whether the baby roach was still around and functioning. She was in too pleasant a mood to harm anything. While she was studying the linoleum, the telephone rang in the narrow hall. Mrs. Riley corked her bottle and put it in the cold oven.
"Hello,"
she said into the telephone.
"Hey, Irene,"
a woman's hoarse voice asked.
"What are you doing, babe? It's Santa Battaglia."
"How are you making, honey?"
"I'm beat. I just finished opening 4 dozen oysters out in the backyard,"
Santa said in her rocky baritone.
"That's hard work, believe me, banging that oyster knife on them bricks."
"I wouldn't try nothing like that,"
Mrs. Riley said honestly.
"I don't mind. When I was a little girl, I used to open oysters up for my mama. She had her a little seafood stand outside the Lautenschlager market. Poor mama, right off the boat. Couldn't speak a word of English, hardly. There I was, just a little thing, breaking them oysters open. I didn't go to no school. Not me, babe. I was right there with them oysters banging away on the banquette. Every now and then, mama started banging away on me for something. We always had a lot of commotion around our stand, us."
"Your mama was very excitable, huh?"
"Poor girl. Standing there in the rain and cold with her old sunbonnet on, not knowing what nobody was saying half the time. It was hard in them days, Irene. Things was tough, kid."
"You can say that again," Mrs. Riley agreed. "We sure had us some hard times down on Dauphin Street. Papa was very poor. He had him a job by a wagon works, but then the automobiles come in, and he gets his hand caught in a fan belt. Many's the week we lived on red beans and rice."
"Red beans gives me gas."
"Me too. Santa, why you called, sugar?"
"Oh, yeah, I almost forgot. You remember when we was out bowling the other night?"
"Tuesday?"
"No, it was Wednesday, I think. Anyway, it was the night Angelo got arrested and couldn't come."
"Wasn't that awful? The police arresting one of their very own."
"Yeah, poor Angelo. He's so sweet. He sure got trouble at that precinct."
Santa coughed hoarsely into the telephone.
"Anyway, it was the night you come for me in that car of yours, and we went to the alley alone. This morning I was over by the fish market buying the oysters, and this old man comes up to me and says, 'Wasn't you by the bowling alley the other night?' So I says, 'Yeah, mister, I go there a lot.' And he says, 'Well, I was there with my daughter and her husband, and I seen you with a lady got sort of red hair.' I says, 'You mean the lady got the henna hair? That's my friend Miss Riley. I'm learning her how to bowl.' That's all, Irene. He just tips his hat and walks out the market."
"I wonder who that could be,"
Miss Riley said with great interest.
"That's sure funny.
What he looks like, babe? Nice man, kinda old. I seen him around the neighborhood before, taking some little kids to mass. I think they're his grandchildren. Ain't that strange? Who'd be asking about me?
I don't know, kid, but you better watch out. Somebody's got their eye on you.
Aw, Santa, I'm too old, girl.
Listen to you. You still cute, Irene. I seen plenty of men giving you the eye in the bowling alley.
Aw, go on.
That's the truth, kid. I ain't lying. You've been stuck away with that son of yours too long.
Ignatia says he's making good at Levy Pants,
Mrs. Riley said defensively.
I don't want to get mixed up with no old man.
He ain't that old,
Santa said, sounding a little hurt.
Listen, Irene, me and Angelo coming by for you about 7 tonight.
I don't know, darling. Ignatius been telling me I ought to stay home more.
Why you gotta stay home, girl? Angelo says he's a big man.
Ignatius says he's afraid when I leave him alone here at night. He says he's scared of burglars.
Bring him along and Angelo can learn him how to bowl, too.
Woo, Ignatius ain't what you'd call the sporting type,
Mrs. Riley said quickly.
You come along anyways, huh?
Okay,
Mrs. Riley said finally.
I think the exercise is helping my elbow out. I'll tell Ignatius he can lock himself up in his room.
Sure, Santa said. Nobody's gonna hurt him.
We ain't got nothing worth stealing anyways. I don't know where Ignatius gets them ideas of his.
Me and Angelo be by at 7.
Fine. And listen, precious, try and ask by the fish market who that old man is.
The Levy home stood among the pines on a small rise overlooking the gray waters of Bay St. Louis. The exterior was an example of elegant rusticity. The interior was a successful attempt at keeping the rustic out entirely, a permanently 75-degree womb connected to the year-round air-conditioning unit by an umbilicus of vents and pipes that silently filled the rooms with filtered and reconstituted Gulf of Mexico breezes and exhaled the Levy's carbon dioxide and cigarette smoke and ennui. The central machinery of the great life-giving unit throbbed somewhere in the acoustically tiled bowels of the home, like a Red Cross instructor giving cadence in an artificial respiration class. In comes the good air, out goes the bad air, in comes the good air. The home was as sensually comfortable as the human womb supposedly is. Every chair sank several inches at the lightest touch, foam and down surrendering abjectly to any pressure. The tufts of the acrylic nylon carpets tickled the ankles of anyone kind enough to walk on them. Beside the bar, what looked like a radio dial would, upon being turned, make the lighting throughout the house as mellow or as bright as the mood demanded. Located throughout the house within easy walking distance of one another were contour chairs, a massage table, and a motorized exercising board whose many sections prodded the body with a motion that was at once gentle yet suggestive. Levy's Lodge, that was what the sign at the Coast Road said, was a Xanadu of the senses. Within its insulated walls there was something that could gratify anything. Mr. and Mrs. Levy, who considered each other the only ungratifying objects in the home, sat before their television set, watching the colors merge together on the screen.
Pericomo's face is all green, Mrs. Levy said with great hostility. He looks like a corpse. You'd better take this set back to the shop.
I just brought it back from New Orleans this week, Mr. Levy said, blowing on the black hairs of his chest that he could see through the V of his terry cloth robe.
He had just taken a steam bath and wanted to dry himself completely. Even with year-round air conditioning and central heating, one could never be sure.
Well, take it back again. I'm not going to go blind looking at a broken TV.
Oh, shut up. He looks all right.
He does not look all right. Look how green his lips are.
It's the makeup those people use.
You mean to tell me they put green makeup on Como's lips?
I don't know what they do.
Of course you don't,
Mrs. Levy said, turning her aquamarine-lidded eyes toward her husband, who was submerged somewhere among the pillows of a yellow nylon couch. She saw some terry cloth and a rubber shower clog at the end of a hairy leg.
Don't bother me, he said. Go play with your exercising board.
I can't get on that thing tonight. My hair was done today.
She touched the high plasticized curls of her platinum hair.
The hairdresser told me that I should get a wig, too, she said.
What do you want with a wig? Look at all the hair you've got already.
I want a brunette wig. That way I can change my personality.
Look, you're already a brunette anyway, right? So why don't you let your hair grow out naturally and buy a blonde wig?
I hadn't thought of that.
Well, think about it for a while and keep quiet. I'm tired. When I went into town today, I stopped at the company. That always makes me depressed.
What's happening there?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
That's what I thought, Mrs. Levy sighed. You've thrown your father's business down the drain. That's the tragedy of your life.
Christ, who wants that old factory? Nobody's buying the kind of pants they make anymore. That's all my father's fault. When pleats came in the 30s, he wouldn't change over from plain front trousers. He was the Henry Ford of the garment industry. Then, when the plain front came back in the 50s, he started making trousers with pleats. Now you should see what Gonzalez calls the new summer line. They look like those balloon pants the clowns wear in circuses. And the fabric. I wouldn't use it for a dish rag myself.
When we were married, I idolized you, Gus. I thought you had drive. You could have made Levy pants really big. Maybe even an office in New York. It was handed all to you, and you threw it away.
Oh, stop all that crap. You're comfortable.
Your father had character. I respected him.
My father was a very mean and cheap man, a little tyrant. I had some interest in that company when I was young. I had plenty of interest. Well, he destroyed all that with his tyranny. So far as I'm concerned, Levy Pants is his company. Let it go down the drain. He blocked every good idea I had for that firm just to prove that he was the father and I was the son. If I said pleats, he said, no pleats, never. If I said, let's try some of the new synthetics, he said, synthetics over my dead body.
He started peddling pants in a wagon. Look what he built that into. With your start, you could have made Levy Pants nationwide.
The nation is lucky, believe me. I spent my childhood in those pants. Anyway, I'm tired of listening to you talk. Period.
Good. Let's keep quiet. Look, Como's lips are turning pink. You've never been a father figure to Susan and Sandra.
The last time Sandra was home, she opened her purse to get cigarettes and a pack of rubbers falls on the floor right at my feet.
That's what I'm trying to say to you. You never gave your daughters an image. No wonder they're so mixed up. I tried with them.
Listen, let's not discuss Susan and Sandra. They're away at college. We're lucky we don't know what's going on. When they get tired, they'll marry some poor guy and everything will be all right.
Then what kind of a grandfather are you going to be?
I don't know. Let me alone. Go get on your exercising board. Get in the whirlpool bath. I'm enjoying this show.
How can you enjoy it when the faces are all discolored?
Let's not start that again.
Are we going to Miami next month?
Maybe. Maybe we could settle there.
And give up everything we have?
Give up what? They can fit your exercising board in a moving van.
But the company...
The company has made all the money it's ever going to make. Now is the time to sell.
It's a good thing your father's dead. He should have lived to see this.
Mrs. Levy gave the shower shoe a tragic glance.
Now I guess you'll spend all your time at the World Series or the Derby or Daytona. It's a real tragedy, Gus, a real tragedy.
Don't try to make a big Arthur Miller play out of Levy Pants.
Thank goodness I'm around to watch over you. Thank goodness I have an interest in that company. How's Miss Trixie? I hope she's still relating and functioning pretty well.
She's still alive, and that's saying a lot for her.
At least I have an interest in her. You would have thrown her out in the snow long ago.
The woman should have been retired long ago.
I told you, retirement will kill her. She must be made to feel wanted and loved. That woman's a real prospect for psychic rejuvenation. I want you to bring her out here someday. I'd like to really get to work on her.
Bring that old bag here? Are you nuts? I don't want a reminder of Levy Pants snoring in my den. She'll wet all over your couch. You can play with her by long distance.
How typical, Mrs. Levy sighed. How I've stood this heartlessness through the years, I'll never know.
I've already let you keep Trixie at the office, where I know she must drive that Gonzalez nuts all day long. When I went there this morning, everybody was on the floor. Don't ask me what they were doing. It could have been anything.
Mr. Levy whistled through his teeth.
Gonzalez is on the moon, as usual, but you should see this other character working in there. I don't know where they got him from. You wouldn't believe your eyes, believe me. I'm afraid to guess what those three clowns do in that office all day long. It's a wonder nothing's happened already.
Ignatius had decided against going to the Britannia. The movie being shown was a widely praised Swedish drama about a man who was losing his soul, and Ignatius was not particularly interested in seeing it. He would have to speak with the manager of the theater about booking such dull fare. He checked the bolt on his door and wondered when his mother would be coming home. Suddenly, she was going out almost every night. But Ignatius had other considerations at the moment. Opening his desk, he looked at a pile of articles he had once written with an eye on the magazine market. For the journals of opinion, there were Boethius Observed and In Defense of Rosvita, To Those Who Say She Did Not Exist. For the family magazines, he had written The Death of Rex and Children, The Hope of the World. In an attempt to crack the Sunday supplement market, he had done The Challenge of Water Safety, The Danger of Eight-Cylinder Automobiles, Abstinence, the Safest Method of Birth Control, and New Orleans, City of Romance and Culture. As he looked through the old manuscripts, he wondered why he had failed to send any of them off, for each was excellent in its own way. There was a new, extremely commercial project at hand, though. Ignatius quickly cleared the desk by brushing the magazine articles and Big Chief tablets smartly to the floor with one sweep of his paws. He placed a new, loose-leaf folder before him, and printed slowly on its rough cover with a red crayon, The Journal of a Working Boy, or Up from Sloth. When he had finished that, he tore the blue horse bands from the stacks of new lined paper and placed them in the folder. With a pencil, he punched holes in the sheets of Levy stationery, which already held some notes, and inserted them in the front section of the folder. Taking up his Levy Pants ballpoint pen, he began writing on the first sheet of new blue horse paper.
Dear reader, books are immortal sons defying their sires. Plato. I find, dear reader, that I have grown accustomed to the hectic pace of office life, an adjustment which I doubted I could make. Of course, it is true that in my brief career at Levy Pants Limited, I have succeeded in initiating several work-saving methods. Those of you who are fellow office workers and find yourselves reading this incisive journal during a coffee break or such might take note of one or two of my innovations. I direct these observations to officers and tycoons also. I have taken to arriving at the office 1 hour later than I am expected. Therefore, I am far more rested and refreshed when I do arrive, and I avoid that bleak first hour of the working day during which my still sluggish senses and body make every chore a penance. I find that in arriving later, the work which I do perform is of a much higher quality. My innovation in connection with the filing system must remain secret for the moment, for it is rather revolutionary, and I shall have to see how it works out. In theory, the innovation is magnificent. However, I will say that the brittle and yellowing papers in the files constitute a fire hazard. A more special aspect that may not apply in all cases is that my files apparently are tenement for assorted vermin. The bubonic plague is a valid medieval fate. I do believe, though, that contracting the plague in this dreadful century would be only ludicrous. Today our office was at last graced by the presence of our lord and master, Mr. G. Levy. To be quite honest, I found him rather casual and unconcerned. I brought to his attention the sign. Yes, reader, it has finally been painted and posted. A rather imperial fleur-de-lis now gives it added significance. But that, too, elicited little interest on his part. His stay was brief and not at all businesslike,
But who are we to question the motives of these giants of commerce whose whims rule the course of our nation? In time, he will learn of my devotion to his firm, of my dedication. My example, in turn, may lead him to once again believe in Levy Pants. La Trixie still keeps her own counsel, thereby proving herself even wiser than I had thought. I suspect that this woman knows a great deal, that her apathy is a facade for her seeming resentment against Levy Pants. She grows more coherent when she speaks of retirement. I have noticed that she needs a new pair of white socks, her current pair having grown rather gray. Perhaps I shall gift her with a pair of absorbent white athletic socks in the near future. This gesture may affect her and lead her to conversation. She seems to have grown fond of my cap, for she has taken to wearing it rather than her celluloid visor on occasion. As I have told you in earlier installments, I was emulating the poet Milton by spending my youth in seclusion, meditation, and study in order to perfect my craft of writing as he did. My mother's cataclysmic intemperance has thrust me into the world in the most cavalier manner. My system is still in a state of flux. Therefore, I am still in the process of adapting myself to the tension of the working world. As soon as my system becomes used to the office, I shall take the giant step of visiting the factory, the bustling heart of Levy Pants. I have heard more than a little hissing and roaring through the factory door, but my presently somewhat enervated condition precludes a descent into that particular inferno at the moment. Now and then some factory worker straggles into the office to illiterately plead some cause, usually the drunkenness of the foreman, a chronic tosspot. When I am once again whole, I shall visit those factory people. I have deep and abiding convictions concerning social action. I am certain that I can perhaps do something to aid these factory folk. I cannot abide those who would act cowardly in the face of a social injustice. I believe in bold and shattering commitment to the problems of our times. Social note. I have sought escape in the Britannia on more than one occasion, pulled by the attractions of some technicolored horrors, filmed abortions that were offenses against any criteria of taste and decency, reels and reels of perversion and blasphemy that stunned my disbelieving eyes, that shocked my virginal mind, and sealed my valve. My mother is currently associating with some undesirables who are attempting to transform her into an athlete of sorts, depraved specimens of mankind who regularly bowl their way to oblivion. At times I find carrying on my blossoming business career rather painful, suffering as I do from these distractions at home. Health note. My valve did close quite violently this afternoon when Mr. Gonzalez asked me to add a column of figures for him. When he saw the state into which I was thrown by the request, he thoughtfully added the figures himself. I tried not to make a scene, but my valve got the better of me. That office manager could, incidentally, develop into something of a nuisance. Until later, Darryl, your working boy.
Ignatius read what he had just written with pleasure. The journal had all sorts of possibilities. It could be a contemporary, vital, real document of a young man's problems. At last he closed the loose-leaf folder and contemplated a reply to Myrna, a slashing, vicious attack upon her being and worldview. It would be better to wait until he had visited the factory and seen what possibilities for social action there were there. Such boldness had to be handled properly. He might be able to do something with the factory workers which would make Myrna look like a reactionary in the field of social action. He had to prove his superiority to the offensive minx. Picking up his lute, he decided to relax in song for a moment. His massive tongue rolled up over his mustache in preparation, and strumming, he began to sing,
"Tarry no longer toward thine heritage. Haste on thy way, and be of right good cheer."
"Shut up!"
Miss Annie hollered through her closed shutters.
"How dare you!"
Ignatius replied, ripping open his own shutters and looking out into the dark, cold alley.
"Open up there! How dare you hide behind those shutters?"
He ran furiously to the kitchen, filled a pot with water, and rushed back to his room. Just as he was about to throw the water on Miss Annie's still unopened shutters, he heard a car door slam out on the street. some people were coming down the alley. Ignatius closed his shutters and turned off the light, listening to his mother speaking to someone. Patrolman Mancuso said something as they passed under his window, and a woman's hoarse voice said,
"It looks safe to me, Irene. There ain't no lights on. He must have gone to the show."
Ignatius slipped his overcoat on and ran down the hall to the front door as they were opening the kitchen door. He went down the front steps and saw Patrolman Mancuso's white Rambler parked before the house. Bending over with great effort, Ignatius stuck a finger into the valve of one of the tires until the hissing stopped and the tire's bottom pancaked across the brick gutter. Then he walked down the alley, which was just wide enough for his bulk, to the rear of the house. Bright lights were burning in the kitchen, and he could hear his mother's cheap radio through the closed window. Ignatius climbed the back step silently and looked in through the greasy glass of the back door. His mother and Patrolman Mancuso were sitting at the table around an almost full fifth of early times. Patrolman Mancuso looked more downtrodden than ever, but Mrs. Riley was tapping one foot on the linoleum and laughing shyly at what she was watching in the center of the room. A stocky woman with kinky gray hair was dancing alone on the linoleum, shaking her pendulous breasts, which were slung in a white bowling blouse. Her bowling shoes pounded the floor purposefully, carrying the swinging breasts and rotating hips back and forth between the table and the stove. So this was Patrolman Mancuso's aunt. Only Patrolman Mancuso could have something like that for an aunt, Ignatius snorted to himself.
Whoa!
Mrs. Riley screamed gaily.
Santa!
Watch this, kids!
The gray-haired woman screamed back like a prize-fight referee and began shaking lower and lower until she was almost on the floor.
Oh, my God!
Ignatius said to the wind.
You're gonna bust a gut, girl!
Mrs. Riley laughed.
You're gonna go through my good floor!
Maybe you better stop, Aunt Santa, Patrolman Mancuso said morosely. Hell, I ain't stopping now. I just got here,
the woman answered, rising rhythmically.
Who says a grandma can't dance no more?
Holding her arms outward, the woman bumped across the linoleum runway.
Lord!
Mrs. Riley said and guffawed, tipping the whiskey bottle to her glass.
What if Ignatius comes home and sees this?
Fuck Ignatius!
Santa!
Mrs. Riley gasped, shocked, but Ignatius noticed, slightly pleased.
You people cut it out!
Miss Annie screamed through her shutters.
Who's that?
Santa asked Mrs. Riley.
Cut it out before I ring up the cops!
Miss Annie's muffled voice cried.
Please stop!
Patrolman Mancuso pleaded nervously. Chapter 5. Darlene was pouring water into the half-filled liquor bottles behind the bar.
Hey, Darlene, listen to this shit,
Lana Lee commanded, folding the newspaper and weighting it down with her ashtray.
Frida Club, Betty Bumper, and Liz Steele, all of 796 Peter Street, were arrested from El Caballo Lounge, 570 Burgundy Street, last night, and booked with disturbing the peace and creating a public nuisance. According to arresting officers, the incident started when an unidentified man made a proposal to one of the women. The woman's two companions struck the man, who fled from the lounge. The Steele woman threw a stool at the bartender, and the other two women menaced customers in the lounge with stools and broken beer bottles. Customers in the lounge said that the man who fled was wearing bowling shoes.
How's about that? People like that are ruining the quarter. Some honest Joe tries to make off with one of those dykes, and they try to beat him up. Once upon a time, it was nice and straight around here. Now it's all dykes and fairies. No wonder business stinks. I can't stand dykes. I can't.
The only people we get in here at night anymore is plainclothesmen, Darlene said. How come they don't get a plainclothesman after women like that?
This place is turning into a goddamn precinct. All I'm putting on is a benefit show for the Policeman's Benevolent Association,
Lana said disgustedly.
A lot of empty space and few cops throwing signals at each other. Half the time I gotta watch you, Brand, to see you don't try to sell them a drink.
Well, Lana, Darlene said, how am I supposed to know who's a cop? Everybody looks the same to me. She blew her nose. I try to make a living.
You tell a cop by his eyes, Darlene. They're very self-assured. I've been in this business too long. I know every dirty cop angle. The marked bills, the phony clothes. If you can't tell by the eyes, then take a look at the money. It's full of pencil marks and crap.
How am I supposed to see the money? It's so dark in here, I can hardly see the eyes even.
Well, we're going to have to do something about you. I don't want you sitting out here on my stools. You're going to try to sell a double martini to the chief of police one of these nights.
Then let me get on the stage and dance. I got a socko routine.
Oh, shut up, Lana hollered. If Jones knew about the police in the place at night, then goodbye, Discount Porter. Now, look here, Darlene. Don't tell that Jones we suddenly got the whole force in here at night. You know how colored people feel about cops. He might get scared and quit. I mean, I'm trying to help the boy out and keep him off the streets.
Okay, Darlene said. But I ain't making no money. I'm so afraid the guy on the next stool is the police. You know what we need in here to make money?
What? Lana asked angrily.
What we need in here is an animal.
A what? Jesus Christ.
I ain't cleaning up after no animal,
Jones said, bumping his mop noisily against the legs of the bar stools.
Come on over and check under these stools, Lana called to him.
Oh, whoa! Where I miss a spot? Hey!
Look in the paper, Lana, Darlene said. Almost every other club on the street's got them an animal.
Lana turned to the entertainment pages and through Jones's fog studied the nightclub ads.
Well, little Darlene's on the ball. I guess you'd like to become the manager of this club, huh? No, ma'am.
Well, remember that, Lana said, and ran a finger along the ads.
Look at this. They got a snake at Jerry's, got them some doves at the 104, a baby tiger, a chimp. And that's where the people are going, Darlene said. You gotta keep up with things in this business.
Thanks a lot. Since it's your idea, you got any suggestions?
I suggest we vote unanimous against changing over to a zoo.
Keep on the floor, Lana said.
We could use my cockatoo, Darlene said. I've been practicing a smash dance with it. The bird's very smart. You ought to hear that thing talk.
In color bars, people's all the time trying to keep birds out.
Give the birds a chance, Darlene pleaded.
Whoa, Jones said. Watch out. Your orphan friend just pulling in. It's humanitarian time.
George was slouching through the door in a bulky red sweater, white denims, and beige flamenco boots with slim pointed toes. On both his hands there were tattoos of daggers drawn with ballpoint pen.
Sorry, George, nothing for the orphans today, Lana said quickly.
See that? Well, them orphans, they better start applying to the United Farm,
Jones said and blew some smoke on the daggers.
We're having trouble with salary as it is. Charity begin at home.
Huh?
George asked.
They're sure keeping a bunch of hoods in the orphanages these days, Darlene observed. I wouldn't give him nothing, Lana. He's operating some kind of shakedown racket, if you ask me. If this kid's an orphan, I'm the Queen of England.
Come here, Lana said to George and led him out onto the street.
What's the matter?
George asked.
I can't talk in front of those two jerks, Lana said. Look, this new porter's not like the old one. This smartass has been asking me about this orphan crap since he first saw you. I don't trust him. I got cop trouble already.
Then get yourself a new jig. There's plenty around.
I couldn't get a blind Eskimo for the salary I'm paying him. I got him on something of a deal, like discount price. And he thinks if he tries to quit, I can get him arrested for vagrancy. The whole thing's a deal, George. I mean, in my line of business, you gotta keep your eye peeled for a bargain, understand?
But what about me?
This Jones goes out to lunch from 12 to 12:30, so you come around about 12:45. What am I supposed to do with them packages all afternoon? I can't do nothing till after 3. I don't want to be carrying that stuff around.
Go check it in the bus station. I don't care. Just be sure they're safe. I'll see you tomorrow.
Lana went back into the bar.
I sure hope you told that kid off,
Darlene said.
Somebody ought to report him to the Better Business Bureau.
Whoa!
Come on, Lana. Give me and the bird a chance. We're boffo.
It used to be the old Kiwanis types liked to come in and watch a cute girl shake it a little. Now it's got to be with some kind of animal. You know what's wrong with people today? They're sick. It's hard for a person to earn an honest buck.
Lana lit a cigarette and matched Jones cloud for cloud.
Okay. We audition the bird. It's probably safer for you to be on my stage with a bird than on my stools with a cop. Bring in the goddamn bird.
Mr. Gonzalez sat next to his little heater, listening to the sounds of the river, his peaceful soul suspended in a nirvana somewhere far above the two antennae of Levy Pants. His senses subconsciously savored the clatter of rats and the smell of old paper and wood, and the possessed feeling that his pair of baggy Levy Pants gave him. He exhaled a thin stream of filtered smoke and aimed the cigarette's ashes like a marksman directly at the center of his ashtray. The impossible had happened. Life at Levy Pants had become even better. The reason was Mr. Riley. What fairy godmother had dropped Mr. Ignatius J. Riley on the worn and rotting steps of Levy Pants? He was four workers in one. In Mr. Riley's competent hands, the filing seemed to disappear. He was also quite kind to Miss Trixie. There was hardly any friction in the office. Mr. Gonzalez was touched by what he had seen the previous afternoon. Mr. Riley on his knees, changing Miss Trixie's socks. Mr. Riley was all heart. Of course, he was part valve, too. But the constant conversation about the valve could be accepted. It was the only drawback. Looking happily about, Mr. Gonzalez noticed the results of Mr. Riley's handiwork in the office. Tacked to Miss Trixie's desk was a large sign that said Miss Trixie, with an old-fashioned nosegay drawn in crayon in one corner. Tacked to his desk was another sign that said Señor Gonzalez, and was decorated with the crest of King Alfonso. A multi-sectioned cross was nailed to a post in the office, the Libby's tomato juice and Kraft jelly on two sections, awaiting what Mr. Riley had said would be brown paint with some black streaks to suggest the grain of the wood. In several empty ice cream cartons on top of the filing cabinets, beans were already sprouting little vines. The purple monk's cloth drapes that hung from the window next to Mr. Riley's desk created a meditative area in the office. There, the sun cast a claret-colored glow over the 3-foot plaster statue of St. Anthony that stood near the wastebasket. There had never been a worker like Mr. Riley. He was so dedicated, so interested in the business. He was even planning to visit the factory when his valve was better to see how he could improve conditions there. The other workers had always been so unconcerned, so slipshod. The door opened slowly as Miss Trixie made her day's entrance, a large bag preceding her.
"Miss Trixie!"
Mr. Gonzalez said in what was, for him, a very sharp tone.
"Who?"
Miss Trixie cried frantically. She looked down at her tattered nightgown and flannel robe.
"Oh, my goodness!"
she wheezed.
"I thought I felt a little chilly outside. Go home right now." "It's cold outside, Gomez." "You can't stay at Leafy Pants like that. I'm sorry." "Am I retired?"
Miss Trixie asked hopefully.
"No!"
Mr. Gonzalez squeaked.
"I just want you to go home and change. You only live around the block. Hurry up."
Miss Trixie shuffled through the door, banging it closed. Then she came in again to get the bag, which she had left on the floor, and banged out again. By the time Ignatius arrived an hour later, Miss Trixie had not returned. Mr. Gonzalez listened to Mr. Riley's heavy, slow tread on the stairs. The door was thrust open, and the marvelous Ignatius J. Riley appeared, a plaid scarf as large as a shawl wound around his neck, one end of it stuffed down into his coat.
"Good morning, sir,"
he said majestically.
"Good morning,"
Mr. Gonzalez said with delight.
Did you have a nice ride here?
Only fair. I suspect that the driver was a latent speed racer. I had to caution him continually. Actually, we parted company with a degree of hostility on both sides. Where's our little distaff member this morning?
I had to send her home. She came to work this morning in her nightgown.
Ignatius frowned and said,
I do not understand why she was sent away. After all, we are quite informal here.
We are one big family.
I only hope that you have not damaged her morale.
He filled a glass at the water cooler to water his beans.
You may not be surprised to see me appear one morning in my nightshirt. I find it rather comfortable.
I certainly don't mean to dictate what you people should wear,
Mr. Gonzalez said anxiously.
I should hope not. Miss Trixie and I can only take so much.
Mr. Gonzalez pretended to look for something in his desk to avoid the terrible eyes that Ignatius had turned on him.
I shall finish the cross,
Ignatius said finally, removing 2 quarts of paint from the pouch-like pockets of his overcoat.
That's wonderful.
The cross is top priority at the moment. Filing, alphabetizing, all of that must wait until I have completed this project. Then, when I finish the cross, I am going to have to visit the factory. I suspect that those people are screaming for a compassionate ear, a dedicated guide. I may be able to aid them.
Of course. Don't let me tell you what to do.
I won't.
Ignatius stared at the office manager.
At last, my valve seems to permit a visit to the factory. I must not pass up this opportunity. If I wait, it may seal up for several weeks.
Then you must go to the factory today,
the office manager agreed enthusiastically. Mr. Gonzalez looked at Ignatius hopefully, but he received no reply. Ignatius filed his overcoat, scarf, and cap in one of the file drawers and began working on the cross. By 11 o'clock, he was giving the cross its first coat, meticulously applying the paint with a small watercolor brush. Miss Trixie was still AWOL. At noon, Mr. Gonzalez looked over the stack of papers on which he was working and said,
I wonder where Miss Trixie can be.
You have probably broken her spirit,
Ignatius replied coldly. He was dabbing at the rough edges of the cardboard with a brush.
However, she may appear for lunch. I told her yesterday that I was bringing her a luncheon meat sandwich. I have discovered that Miss Trixie considers luncheon meat a rather toothsome delicacy. I would offer you a sandwich, but I am afraid that there are only enough for Miss Trixie and me.
That's quite all right.
Mr. Gonzalez produced a wan smile and watched Ignatius open his greasy brown paper bag.
I'm going to have to work straight through lunch anyway to finish these statements and billings.
Yes, you'd better. We must not allow Levy Pants to fall behind in the struggle for the survival of the fittest.
Ignatius bit into his first sandwich, tearing it in half, and chewed contentedly for a while.
I do hope that Miss Trixie does appear,
he said after he had finished the first sandwich and emitted a series of belches which sounded as if they had disintegrated his digestive tract.
My valve will not tolerate luncheon meat, I'm afraid.
While he was tearing the filling of the second sandwich from the bread with his teeth, Miss Trixie came in, her green celluloid visor facing the rear.
Here she is,
Ignatius said to the office manager through the big leaf of limp lettuce that was hanging from his mouth.
Oh, yes, Mr. Gonzalez said weakly. Miss Trixie.
I imagined that the luncheon meat would activate her faculties. Over here, Mother Commerce.
Miss Trixie bumped into the statue of St. Anthony.
I knew I had something on my mind all morning, Gloria,
Miss Trixie said, taking the sandwich in her claws and going to her desk. Ignatius watched with fascination the elaborate process of gums, tongue, and lips that every piece of sandwich set into motion.
You took a very long time to change,
the office manager said to Miss Trixie, noting bitterly that her new ensemble was only a little more presentable than the robe and nightgown.
Oh?
Miss Trixie asked, sticking out a tongueful of masticated luncheon meat and bread.
I said you took a long time to change. Me? I just left here.
Will you please stop harassing her?
Ignatius demanded angrily. There was no need for the delay. She only lives down by the wharf somewhere, the office manager said and returned to his papers.
Did you enjoy that?
Ignatius asked Miss Trixie when the last grimace of her lips had stopped. Miss Trixie nodded and began industriously on a second sandwich. But when she had at last eaten half, she slumped back in her chair.
Oh, I'm full, Gloria. That was delicious.
Mr. Gonzales, would you care for the bit of sandwich that Miss Trixie cannot eat?
No, thank you.
I wish that you would take it. Otherwise, the rats will storm us en masse.
Yes, Gomez, take this,
Miss Trixie said, dropping the soggy half of uneaten sandwich on top of the papers on the office manager's desk.
Now look what you've done, you old idiot,
Mr. Gonzales screamed.
Damn, Mrs. Levy, that's the statement for the bank. How dare you attack the spirit of the noble Mrs. Levy,
Ignatius thundered.
I shall report you, sir.
It took over an hour to prepare that statement. Look at what she's done.
I want that Easter ham,
Miss Trixie snarled.
Where's my Thanksgiving turkey? I quit a wonderful job as cashier in a Nickelodeon to come to work for this company. Now I guess I'll die in this office. I must say a worker gets shabby treatment around here. I'm retiring right now.
Why don't you go wash your hands? Mr. Gonzales said to her.
That's a good idea, Gomez,
Miss Trixie said, and tacked off to the ladies' room. Ignatius felt cheated. He had hoped for a scene. While the office manager began making a copy of the statement, Ignatius returned to the cross. First, however, he had to lift Miss Trixie, who had returned and was kneeling directly beneath it and praying in the spot where Ignatius had been standing to paint. Miss Trixie hovered about him, leaving only to seal some envelopes for Mr. Gonzales, to visit the bathroom several times, and to catnap. The office manager made the only noise in the office with his typewriter and adding machine, both of which Ignatius found slightly distracting. By 1:30, the cross was almost finished. It lacked only the little gold-leaf letters that spelled God and Commerce, which Ignatius had ready to apply across the bottom of the cross. After the motto was applied, Ignatius stood back and said to Miss Trixie,
"It is complete."
"Oh, Gloria, that's beautiful,"
Miss Trixie said sincerely.
"Look at this, Gomez."
"Isn't that fine?" Mr. Gonzales said, studying the cross with tired eyes.
"Now to the filing," Ignatius said busily. "Then off to the factory. I cannot tolerate social injustice."
"Yes, you must go to the factory while your valve is operating,"
the office manager said. Ignatius went behind the filing cabinets, picked up the accumulated and unfiled material, and threw it in the wastebasket. Noticing that the office manager was sitting at his desk with his hand over his eyes, Ignatius pulled out the first drawer of the files, and turning it over, dumped its alphabetical contents into the wastebasket too. Then he lumbered off to the factory door, thundering past Miss Trixie, who had fallen to her knees again before the cross. Patrolman Mancuso had tried a little moonlighting in his effort to apprehend someone, anyone, with the sergeant. After dropping off his aunt from the bowling alley, he had stopped in the bar on his own to see what he could turn up. What had turned up was these three terrifying girls who had struck him. He touched the bandage on his head as he entered the precinct to see the sergeant, who had summoned him.
"What happened to you, Mancuso?"
the sergeant screamed when he saw the bandage.
"I fell down."
"That sounds like you. If you knew anything about your job, you'd be in bars tipping us off on people like those three girls we brought in last night."
"Yes, sir."
"I don't know what whore gave you the tip on this night of joy, but our boys have been in there almost every night and they haven't turned up anything."
"Well, I thought..."
"Shut up. You gave us a phony lead. You know what we do to people give us a phony lead?"
"No."
"We put them in the restroom at the bus station."
"Yes, sir."
"You stay in the booth there 8 hours a day until you bring somebody in."
"Okay."
"Don't say okay. Say yes, sir. Now get out of here and go look in your locker. You're a farmer today.
Ignatius opened the journal of a working boy to the first unused sheet of blue horse loose-leaf filler, officiously snapping the point of his